morning. You're listening to WHCL 88.7 FM, and my guest today is Ed Kanan. We're going to be speaking about the School of the Americas. Welcome, Ed.
Hi. Good to be with you, Pete.
Good to have you. Well, first, let's give the listeners a little background about what the school is. I'm sure there's many of our listeners haven't even heard of the School of the Americas.
Well, it's gone by various names over the years. When they find it convenient, they take on a new alias. Mm-hmm. So now it's not really called the School of the Americas officially. It's the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And it changed its name, 8 or so years ago because it became so notorious.
Yeah, I think it was the first time I went, maybe in 2001, that they had just changed the name.
Right. Yeah, and it had to do that because it had become known to the public.
Mm-hmm.
It had been operating in obscurity for decades, actually since the 1940s, you know, post-World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It began in Panama, but the people in Panama were not very happy with having it there, so they threw it out. And the United States military, who runs it, looked for another site in Latin America and couldn't find one, so it moved up to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
In 1984, I believe. And it was called the School of the Americas. And what it does is, all the instruction is in Spanish. So most of the students come from various militaries in Latin America. And the primary thrust of the schooling there is in anti-insurgency tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means is that it's training those military in tactics, which they then use against people in their own countries, people whom the power structure of those countries don't like,
mm-hmm.
you know, like labor organizers, literacy workers, nuns, priests, people who are striving to help the people in those countries achieve human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
So the governments don't like those kinds of people, so they use the military to suppress them. Now, not only don't the governments like those kinds of people,
mm-hmm.
but the U.S. corporations operating in those countries aren't very happy with them because it might lead to demanding higher wages, or it might lead to demanding higher payment for the resources that the corporations are extracting,
mm-hmm.
oil, copper, so forth.
I remember the first year that I went there, I saw this, someone was handing out leaflets about Killer Coke, Coca-Cola,
uh-huh.
and it said Colombian Coke Float, and it had an image of dead bodies floating in this, it was an artist's rendering of dead bodies floating in a Coca-Cola
mm-hmm.
Glass, and they were talking about how the Coca-Cola companies that were in South America were killing off their labor organizers. They're having them assassinated.
Well, that was particularly true in Colombia. And so, in fact, there's been this nationwide boycott on Coke products. So I don't know if at the school they serve Coke products, but a good project might be for activists locally is to get the schools in the area not to carry Coke products.
Right, definitely. And the other one that was popular the year I went was the workers working for Taco Bell that they were getting something like 3 cents a bushel for
uh-huh.
tomatoes picked or something like that. They just wanted a 1 cent increase on their per bushel of tomatoes.
Yeah, like those in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a whole range of products like Coca-Cola who find Latin America a very good market for their products. So they have a strong influence in those countries. And that doesn't help the people any. I mean, Coke, just the product Coke, well, it tastes great when you're in the tropics, isn't necessarily very good for the people. It doesn't encourage those governments to provide good water supplies.
Right.
And protect the water supply.
Mm-hmm. Well, I even heard that in India, their Coca-Cola was getting all the rights to the water, using all the people's water, leaving them with no drinking water, but they could buy Coca-Cola's drink.
Yeah, yeah, it's you know, it's a brutal system, you know, the capitalism that we export.
Mm-hmm.
And the School of the Americas provides the muscle to enforce it. You know, Thomas Friedman, the capitalist columnist in the New York Times, he said that without McDonnell Douglas, which, you know, manufactures weapon systems, there could be no McDonald's.
Huh.
That was his comment on globalism, that
uh-huh.
it depends on the military muscle to sustain it.
Mm-hmm. So who was the first person to realize what the School of the Americas was doing and raise a stink about it?
Well, I think you're thinking of Father Roy Bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
Father Roy was a Marianole missioner in Bolivia back in the 80s, and he was arrested and tortured by the strong man there who was trained at the School of the Americas. And then he traveled to Father Roy. He was deported from Bolivia, and he traveled to El Salvador and got to know people in El Salvador and the struggle there. And some of his friends were, you know, Catholic church women who were, four of them were raped and murdered by military in El Salvador. And it was military that had been that had trained at the School of the Americas. Then in 1989, November 16th, 1989, the Atlacatl Battalion of the Salvadoran military invaded the campus at the University of Central America in San Salvador, the capital, and slaughtered six Jesuit priests, you know, professors,
mm-hmm.
and their housekeeper and her daughter, Selena. So that was November 16th, 1989. And a U.S. congressional investigation of that massacre found that 19 of the 26 officers involved in that massacre had just trained at the School of the Americas.
Mm.
So when Roy found out about that, he actually moved to Fort Benning, Georgia, well, to Columbus, Georgia, which is just outside the gates of Fort Benning, and got an apartment directly across the street from the main gate. And he began this organization called SOA Watch, which has been ongoing since then. It's grown from one man to, you know, a nationwide movement. And every year around November 16th, there's a great gathering at the gates of Fort Benning, which, you know, invariably involves civil disobedience and people being arrested, going to court, and going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, again, you know, people will be gathering now in their thousands. I mean, 10, 15, 20,000 people from all over the country will gather there on the weekend before Thanksgiving.
It's going to be the 21st to the 23rd this year.
Right, yeah. And every year, like on Saturday of the weekend, there's workshops and concerts and music and speakers. It's quite an event. And then on Sunday morning, it becomes like a liturgy or a very somber event in which names of victims of officers from the School of the Americas are recited out loud. And people process holding up, you know, white crosses with the names of victims. It's a very solemn, somber, moving event.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that event, you know, some people in the procession kind of go off and penetrate into the base, Fort Benning, and you know, are arrested. Invariably, they're tried in court, convicted, and go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
We've had scores and scores of people go to prison on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And each time people go to prison, it just helps spread the word. More and more other people learn about it. And it's been sort of this what has helped the movement grow. It's what we call prison witness.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Central New York, we've had over a dozen people go to prison over the SOA issue. You know, some for as long as a year.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to tell us about your experience?
Well, I've been involved in the issue since 1994. I heard Father Roy speak up here in Syracuse in a church basement, and was very moved by him. I hope all of your listeners have a chance to hear Father Roy sometime. It was a life-changing experience for me to hear him and then to join his 40-day fast on the steps of the Capitol a few weeks later. So we went, a bunch of us went without food for 40 days, and then that November we gathered down at Fort Benning and we reenacted the massacre of the Jesuits right there at the entrance to the base, and that led to prison terms for about 13 of us. So then each year I would come back to Fort Benning along with a lot of other folks from Central New York as well. And another time I was also, you know, several times I was also arrested for crossing the line into the base, and ended up spending about a year in prison, you know, in federal prison. So those were kind of the, you know, pivotal experiences for me in terms of the School of the Americas. It also involved for me a lot of writing of articles, a lot of appearances, you know, giving talks around the country. And then here in Syracuse, we've got a pretty active group called the SOA Abolitionists, which is a, you know, we want to abolish the School of the Americas, close it down, but it's also a nod to the fact that here in Central New York, we've got quite a tradition of abolition, you know, harking back to the Civil War years.
Right. Can you tell me about the first year that Father Roy did something at the school?
Right. Well, if I recall right, that was 1990. The six Jesuits and their housekeeper and her daughter were had been massacred. That was 1989. I'm sorry. That was 1989. But well before that, the Archbishop of El Salvador, Archbishop Romero, had been assassinated. And I mentioned earlier those four church women who had been raped and murdered. So that was about 1980. And when Roy heard about that, he and a couple of close compadres, compañeros, entered the base. They were dressed as military officers and were able to go to the barracks where the Salvadoran soldiers were lodged. And Roy climbed up into a tree, and he had a boombox with him. And when it got to be dark, he started playing the boombox, which had the last sermon of Archbishop Romero. And he boomed it out toward the soldiers, the Salvadoran soldiers in the barracks. And basically it told them to stop, the sermon told the soldiers to stop killing their fellow Salvadorans, their brothers and sisters.
Wow.
So imagine the ruckus that caused.
That's incredible. That's I hadn't heard that one. What I was thinking of, that's much more interesting, was the 1 year he ran through there with a few other people, and they threw paint on the walls, red paint, through the hallways of the building.
Okay, yeah. I actually wasn't a part of that and don't have direct knowledge of it. But there had been, from about 1990 to about 1994, a number of quite dramatic actions on the base perpetrated by Father Roy and some colleagues. Now, a turning point came in 1994 when we decided not to do these dramatic actions on the base, but rather do them at the main gate, which that permitted the public to be involved in.
Right.
And that led to a great growth in the organization, because now the public can could be involved in these actions.
Do you have any knowledge if the local public was interested, or was this people coming from far away?
Mostly it was people coming from far away, although the neighbors seemed quite supportive of us, friendly. But yeah, actually, at that time, it was mostly older folks, like retired folks, you know, who could risk prison. Mm-hmm. And it continued to be largely older folks and largely Catholic folks for those first several years. But then the movement grew and came to include, you know, people from lots of different faith traditions. And a lot of students started coming, high school students and college students. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, the crowds, you know, they're 15,000-18,000 people, are very mixed, very diverse, and include, you know, just thousands upon thousands of young people from countries, you know, from schools all over the country. They come by the busload, mm-hmm. the van load.
Well, I'd like to tell the listeners, if you're out there listening now and you'd like to get in on this conversation, if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call in the studio. The telephone number is 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. And if you'd like to check out the SOA Watch website, that's soaw.org.
Pete, this might be a good moment to mention that I'll be in Utica tomorrow night.
Correct.
Giving a talk about the School of the Americas. It'll be at a place called The Other Side, mm-hmm. which is at 2011 Genesee Street in Utica, and begins at 7 p.m. tomorrow evening, and that's free and open to the public.
And what will these people be able to expect when they come to your presentation?
Well, what I generally do is I show a video. SOA Watch has several excellent videos about the movement and the actions and about conditions in Latin America, and, you know, give some talk about, you know, the background of the SOA Watch movement, story of the SOA itself. And then I like to open it up to Q&A. Mm-hmm. I really don't like to talk a great deal, but just to, you know, respond to questions people might have. Mm-hmm. The film, I think I'll show the film called Guns and Greed, which ties in the School of the Americas with you know, the U.S. corporate interests in Latin America, mm-hmm. and does so in a vivid, dramatic fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was asked by family members why I have to go down and participate in something like this, and I told them that when I found out that my government was torturing people in other countries, that I had to go and do something about it and make my opposition heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't learn about this. I was until I was traveling with a friend, and we were in Tennessee. We were going cross country, and she received an email from someone that invited us to SOA. And
yeah.
That was right after the September 11th attacks, and we went down there.
Uh huh.
And it was quite an amazing experience.
I'm sure it was, and it is an amazing experience for thousands of people. Just the sense of community and solidarity, I think you would probably agree, was very strong.
Mm-hmm. And to see the puppetistas there?
Yeah, yeah.
And
these enormous puppets that process with us.
Mm-hmm. And they, the puppets themselves tell a story, so you just see an image of, a still image of the protest, and you can already begin to read the story of the grieving mothers, or
mm-hmm.
The year I went, there was a top-down power system that was created in puppet style.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that was amazing was all the information that was available there. There's people that are covering all different social justice issues, and there's a lot of information available to take back with you.
Well, it's really a sort of a grand bazaar of movement organizations. You know, lots and lots of grassroots organizations from all over the country come, and, you know, they have their booths, their tables, you know, their literature tables, and a vast range of issues. And, you know, it's an opportunity to do your holiday shopping, because there's, you know, bumper stickers and books and CDs and T-shirts, and a very festive atmosphere on Saturday, Friday night and Saturday.
And the festive atmosphere included people singing, dancing,
yeah.
drumming, puppeting, stilting.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of the neighborhood kids get involved in that. You'll see neighborhood kids stilting. It's a black neighborhood. It's pretty low income, and they're very glad to see us every year. But then on Sunday morning, it kicks into quite a somber liturgical kind of mood, which is also very moving and powerful, and colorful. I mean, it's a memorable weekend.
That was my first protest, and every protest I've gone to since that wasn't the SOA, I've been disappointed with.
I understand. Yeah,
my first expectation.
I think the SOA issue in coming in November is a wonderful starter event or a starter issue. You know, for people that haven't been involved on the, haven't been hit the streets and haven't been activists, this is a very good way to begin. For one thing, it's a very safe environment. I didn't mention all the arrests, but that's people that have chosen that route. It's a very safe environment because everyone is committed to nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And so what you find is that parents bring their kids, their infants. Mm-hmm. There's people in wheelchairs. There's a lot of elderly people. There's a lot of nuns and priests and clergy from a whole range of faith traditions. So it's very safe. But it's also very consciousness-raising. I mean, you learn about U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. And boy, if you weren't aware of that before, mm-hmm. Like most U.S. people aren't, mm-hmm. It's just so eye-opening and just leads to just seeing the world in quite different eyes if you're paying attention.
And that was brought to my attention again when I read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine.
Yes, excellent book. Excellent book. I just finished it like last week.
Oh.
But yeah, very powerful.
So that was a reminder to me about the School of the Americas, and then I saw a poster for your talk, and that made me very excited.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the legislation of last year, and do you know how long that's been going on, the legislation to cut funding?
Well, the legislative, it's like the other prong. I mentioned the court witness and the prison witness, which are just essential to this movement. But unless we can get Congress to close the place down, then, we really haven't succeeded. So there has to be a legislative prong that goes with this. A few years ago, SOA Watch, which was based right across the street from the military base there, opened up an office in Washington, D.C., to primarily lobby Congress. So for a number of years now, since the mid-90s, there has been legislation introduced into Congress to close the school. And each year, that kind of gets more and more momentum and gets closer and closer to closing the school. Now, the current situation is that there's going to be probably a good deal of change in Congress with this coming election.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be like new legislation introduced soon, I expect, in both the Senate and the House. And there's some chance. I mean, every year we think, closing the school is just around the corner,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't happened. But there is some chance that, next year, 2009, we may be successful in closing the school.
Well, this past year was only 4 votes away from cutting off funding.
Yeah, very close. Yeah, yeah.
So that's a pretty, the gap really got close there.
Yeah, yeah. So there definitely is hope that this thing can be closed down, which does not mean that the U.S. military will stop trying to teach Latin American military, all the dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm.
But it will get in their way, because this is one place where Latin American military who don't speak English can get training. So if we can kind of break that up, that'll be a good thing.
Right. And what about people who go to the protests who want to bring the information home? Do you know anything about getting this into your local newspaper or get your local television station to cover it? I know they spoke about that when I went there, but I didn't get all of the details about how to go about that.
Yeah. Well, here in Syracuse, we had some very good success with the local media. In fact, over the years, we've had, you know, like over a dozen editorials in the Syracuse Post-Standard and the Syracuse Herald-Journal, which is, you know, the latter is now defunct, calling for closing the school. And I think that was a lot in part because, you know, a number of Central New Yorkers had gone to prison. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of dramatic, and, you know, it made the newspapers, local newspapers, sit up and take notice. Mm-hmm. So we got very good media play. Especially during the 90s and the early 2000s when our people were going to prison. There's been less of that since we haven't had people go to prison, say, in the last several years. I think there's been a lot of focus on the Iraq War locally.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there's all kinds of opportunities in the media. I mean, you're a media person. For people who, when they come back, to, you know, write a press release. And alert their local media, you know, about the fact that they were down there and about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if they do choose to risk arrest, you know, the local media probably would be very interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I wrote a lot of press releases over the years in connection with School of the Americas, and it felt very gratifying because this is a open and shut case. I mean, there's nothing redeeming about the School of the Americas. It's not an ambiguous issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think newspapers kind of like to have those issues to kind of play with editorially. You know, because it's kind of safe, you know. It's not up here in Central New York that we're demanding a base to be closed. It's, you know,
right,
1,000 miles away. So that's pretty safe.
Yeah.
And so the media, who tend to be kind of conservative, can go with it.
Another thing that impressed me very much about the demonstration is that all of the work that goes into the pre-demonstration, all
mm-hmm.
of the workshops and teaching people how to be nonviolent, how to be peacekeepers, about what's going to be happening, and all of those sort of things that really help to educate the first time person who's going to be there.
Yeah, that's one of the, I think, one of the terrific things about the weekend down in Columbus, Georgia in November, is there's such a range of workshops and trainings on all different issues, but with a real focus on nonviolence. So those folks who might be interested in trying to understand nonviolence better, you know, have an opportunity to take workshops and learn about nonviolence. It's a very rich experience. Some very good trainers are there.
And so for people who are interested in going, how do they find out where, how to get a ride share or something, how to get there?
Well, here in Syracuse, you know, we have this organization, SOA Abolitionists, that go down every year. And so, you know, there's just, you know, a handful of cars that drive down. Some people fly. And then campuses all across the country, there are groups that, you know, get together in vans or buses that go. I don't know if there's campuses near you, but there used to be, you know, like from Colgate and Cornell and Hamilton and here up in Lemoyne, you know, groups that would go down. So if folks get, check SOAwatch.org, the website for the national organization, that might give them some tips about what's going on in their area in terms of others going down and logistics and so forth, you know, who you can contact.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to speak about?
Well, you know, sometimes if folks will ask me about, you know, prison experience, what that was like. You know, that could be a direction to go in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am interested in that. I just I didn't want to bring it up just in case you didn't want to go there. But.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, I occasionally give talks about the School of the Americas, like I'll be doing tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want to have a bio from you, and I always mention, you know, that I've gone to prison, federal prison, twice for the SOA Watch issue. And often, when I'm being introduced, you know, they go through my bio, but they don't mention that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's too bad, that inhibition, because there's nothing stigmatizing about going to prison for a good cause.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think this would probably be a much better country if more folks would be willing to go to prison, you know, for the right causes,
mm-hmm.
and to do so out of an ethic of nonviolence. So I do feel like that was a very important thing for me to have done, you know, for my own conscience raising, from my own politics. But I think it has very good effects, too, on the community around you.
The year I was at SOA, there was a gentleman who was speaking, and he said every good Christian ought to go to prison at least
uh-huh.
once in their life.
Uh-huh. Well, my twist on that is a little different, but it's really the same, which is that I think, like, every middle-class person, certainly, should have some experience with their local jail to know what the conditions are in their local jail.
Mm-hmm.
So to not be afraid of going to jail. Yeah, sure, there's some inconvenience, some disruption and business as usual and so forth, some discomfort, some indignity. But, you know, compared to what the people in Latin America suffer
mm-hmm.
at the hands of those military officers trained at the School of the Americas, you know, and such things as torture and sniping and interrogation and so forth, it's nothing, really. You know, a little bit of time in prison is really nothing compared to that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found during my two prison stays was that there was tremendous solidarity expressed to me in terms of, like, letters
mm-hmm.
from people in the SOA Watch movement from all over the country and people outside that movement, you know, that hear you're in prison. I mean, people write to people in prison who are there for, you know, good political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very heartening. Because it did feel, you know, from their correspondence, that in some way I was inspiring people. You know, inspiring people to think about these hard issues and maybe inspiring people to, you know, take a little risk themselves. And that felt very good.
When you were in prison, was it solitary or were you with other prisoners?
Well, you're very much with other prisoners because the prisons are so crowded. You don't have a cell to yourself. You're double bunked, so there's two of you. And I think, you know, there's a lot of variety in prison conditions, so I could, you know, basically only speak from my own experience. But that was my experience, and it's probably, you know, pretty typical. At one point, I was put in the SHU, the Segregated Housing Unit, for an infraction. I was kept in there for about 10 days, and it's you know, it's like solitary, except there were two of us in solitary. So, which could have been hellish, you know, if it had been an incompatible cellmate, but it turned out that, you know, my cellmate and I were quite compatible, and actually it was a good 10 days or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say I think prison was for me an easier experience than it would be for most people, because I've been an activist for many years. And I've lived very simply, and I haven't gotten as dependent on a lot of, you know, the standard consumption stuff that people in the U.S. are dependent on. So I didn't feel, you know, very deprived
mm-hmm.
being in prison, you know, the material things. And also I was very fortunate that my partner Ann was very supportive of me, and, you know, she also goes down to Fort Benning every year in November, and in fact spent 6 months in prison herself for crossing the line at Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that, and my family, which sort of, they were Nixon Republicans, you know, way back when, I guess had enough respect for me and so forth that my going to prison kind of opened their eyes, and they came around to, you know, supporting me.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great. Now, that doesn't happen for everyone,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I don't want to gloss over that there are things that can be pretty disruptive in one's life if you go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've been an activist over the years, and I haven't had a career otherwise, you know, it wasn't like I lost my job because of it.
Right.
And that's a very real serious consideration.
Right.
Or, like in November, you get arrested, then in the winter you have a trial, and then in the spring you go to prison. Well, that could be pretty disruptive for some people's schooling,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is a real consideration.
While you were in prison, did you talk to other people that were in prison, and did you guys talk about the School of the Americas?
You know, I did somewhat, but my focus, you know, I had been pretty busy with School of the Americas activism and so forth, and that was pretty frenetic. And when I got to prison, I kind of approached it as if it was a sabbatical year
mm-hmm.
or a year of retreat. And I did an enormous amount of reading.
Mm-hmm.
That was my focus. And I wasn't seeking to, like, proselytize or, you know, affect, you know, other prisoners, really. I was, you know, it just wasn't the direction I was going in.
Mm-hmm. And were there issues that you learned about from other prisoners who were there?
Well, actually, I learned more vicariously. You know, when Anne was in Danbury for 6 months, she was in for 6 months. She came out, and then 2 weeks later, I went in for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So there was about a year and a half there where we were separated. But I would hear about the condition of women in prison, which is really rotten. I mean, I had it much better off than she did
mm-hmm.
in prison. You know, like we had a library, a good library. And like, you know, she had like two shelves of romances with the reading matter available there, you know, for her.
That's terrible.
It was terrible. Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, very bright, well-educated woman and, you know, there's just no intellectual sustenance, which I really need, you know.
Uh-huh.
But what I did learn was, you tend to read a lot on prison issues. Because you're kind of, you know, your face is being rubbed in it. So I did read a lot about prison issues while I was in, and that certainly raised my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the learning.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just there's a little static on the line here. I was just checking that out.
Yeah.
But. I suppose that's all the questions I have for you about SOA and that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to read here from SOA Watch's site about a few places that are in New York that people can check out.
Excellent.
There's Amnesty International at Ithaca College, and there's Binghamton's SOA Watch. There's a Buffalo area, Buffalo State Students for Peace, Ithaca College Catholic Community, Ithaca Central New York Committee on U.S. and Latin American Relations, Long Island Students for Peace and Humanity, Long Island SOA Watch, New Jewel Movement, not sure where that is, it's in the New York City SOA Watch, Peace Work, SOA WIC Watch, Syracuse School of America's Abolitionists, Troy Upstate Capital Region, Rosa House Peace Community, Troy Catholic Worker, and Wells College.
Uh-huh. Well, it's pretty well spread through the state and,
yep.
and through many states. Yeah.
Well, since we kind of wrapped up on SOA for the time being, could you tell me about your new focus?
Well, one of my close SOA Watch friends, Rick McDowell, while he was also going to SOA Watch every year, and his wife was spending a year in prison,
mm-hmm.
In fact, they got married in prison, he was leading delegations to Iraq frequently. And so I keep hearing about Iraq from Rick. And so my mom died on Christmas Day 2002, and that kind of freed me up to... think in terms of maybe, you know, some more dramatic activism, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to go to Iraq in early 2003 with a group called Voices in the Wilderness.
Wow, I've heard of that group, and we've read some of their literature on the program here.
Well, good. So some of your listeners then would know that what Voices in the Wilderness has been doing since 1996 is taking delegations to Iraq, and also medical supplies, because thanks to the UN and the U.S. sanctions against Iraq, you know, the people of Iraq were really short on medical supplies. Mm-hmm. So these delegations would bring medical supplies to the people of Iraq, and they'd be doing so illegally because, you know, the U.S. was not doesn't want U.S. citizens in places that it's sort of demonizing, because when U.S. citizens come back, you know, they kind of tell what their concrete experiences were, and they give a very different picture than what the U.S. government is putting out there. So anyway, Rick was very involved in that. So that led me to get involved. And so in early 2003, I went to Baghdad with Voices in the Wilderness and stayed for about 10 weeks. And this included the time of shock and awe, you know, when the U.S. invaded. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of a ringside seat on shock and awe. The little hotel our group was staying in was right on the Tigris, and just directly across the river was some of the most intense bombing of the war. So, you know, we were able to see that. And there was bombing on our side, too. In fact, we were just across the street from the Palestine Hotel, which is where the international media were staying. Mm-hmm. And in the closing days of the invasion, you know, the Hotel Palestine got shelled.
Wow.
And those shells would have gone right... Can't hear me?
Oh, there you go. We're back.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't know what happened, but we lost you.
I was talking about Baghdad.
Oh, you're talking about the hotel getting shelled.
Right. So this is just across the street from us. I didn't know personally the journalists that were killed, but you know, some of the people in our team, you know, knew them personally. And the curious thing about that, you know, of course, the Marines who did the shelling said, "Oh, it was an accident," you know, but. That same day, other media were shelled as well, you know, Arab-speaking media there in Baghdad. So it certainly seems to be a pattern rather than an accident that
yeah.
it happened.
Yeah.
I think my interpretation of it was that as the military came, U.S. military came into Baghdad, they wanted to make it clear to the international press that they didn't want them there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just it was an act of terrorism.
Right.
To sort of lead journalists to leave the country. And some did. I mean, some were prudent and left the country.
Yeah, to intimidate coverage.
Yeah, yeah. So I was there in April for, to about mid-April, you know, after the Marines came into Baghdad. And then I went back to the States, you know, to do speaking mm-hmm. about what I'd experienced and seen. And then, like August 2003, I returned to Baghdad and was there for about 10 more weeks, you know, till November. So it was about 5 months altogether in that first year with Voices in the Wilderness, living in Baghdad, but also traveling, you know, up to Mosul, up to Kurdistan, and down to Basra, and actually down to the Kuwait border as well. So, you know, a very interesting time for me. I've been sort of focused on, you know, Iraq ever since.
Mm-hmm.
I do get down to School of the Americas every year, but that's been less of my focus in last, you know, recent years.
Have you made a connection with any of the U.S. military that was there, or the guys that left the military, like the Winter Soldier group?
Yeah, there's been some connection. The day that the Marines came into Baghdad, that was April 8th or 9th, 2003, they surrounded the Palestine Hotel, you know, tanks and machine gun nests and so forth. Very intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
But that also meant, in effect, that our little hotel was surrounded, too. And so our group, there was about 30 of us that stayed there with Voices in the Wilderness, you know, through the shock and awe. And, of course, an important topic of conversation, you know, throughout those weeks was, you know, what will happen when the U.S. military comes to Baghdad. We were there illegally. You know, Voices in the Wilderness didn't have any permit to be there from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So, in effect, we were practicing, you know, protracted civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know if we would just be rounded up and, you know, taken to Guantanamo or wherever, you know, they take people. But we wanted to be some, we wanted to somehow encounter the troops when they came in. So what we did was we had these photos of Iraqis that one of our people took, and we blew them up on these laminated, like and laminated them, and we hung these outside the south side of the hotel, so that the journalists next door could see them, just pictures of Iraqi people, and then also as the military came in, you know, they would see them. Mm-hmm. And then in the afternoon, when the military actually did come in, we unrolled a banner. Oh, it was probably about, I don't know, 16 or 18 feet long, and hung that from the balconies so they would see it. And the banner said, courage for peace, not for war. Now, my friend Neville, who was a minister from Australia, who was part of our group, he, a man in his mid-70s, what he wanted to do was to go down into the street with a sign saying, Yankee, go home. Well, some of our people thought that wouldn't be such a great idea because it might just, you know, alienate these warriors that were coming in from the desert. And there was, you know, Iraqi people living in the hotel, too, with us. So what he did instead, he heard what people were saying, and so what he did is he just stood on his balcony, which was like the second floor balcony, facing the tanks, and he had a sign, I think it said, war equals terrorism. Mm-hmm. So he just did that. He just stood there silently without moving from about 3 in the afternoon, you know, when the tanks arrived, till dusk.
Wow.
And then Cynthia Banas, who was on the team, and she's from Central New York.
Yeah, her name is familiar to me.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. She's been a remarkable activist for decades in Central New York. She said, you know, those guys down there, they're probably real thirsty, the guys in the tank. And we had a whole room full of bottled water, you know, that we had bought before the invasion started, in which we hadn't finished drinking. So she and some of the other people on our team, you know, got these six packs of water and walked down. And I went with them, but I had very mixed feelings about this. I didn't want to be seen fraternizing with the invader. On the other hand, part of nonviolence is, you know, seeing the divine in everyone. Mm-hmm. So I went down with them. As Cynthia presented the water to the guys in the tanks, and they were very appreciative, you know, and I just kind of stood there, not saying a word, looking pretty stern, probably, but I just wasn't prepared to speak with them, because I was so angry about this invasion,
mm-hmm.
So I didn't trust myself at that point to talk with these guys, but, you know, Cynthia, she just began talking with them, and pretty soon move the conversation, you know, into the issues of the invasion very deftly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we also had on our team two young people from South Korea, and they had brought with them a mural that was, you know, rolled up. It was quite big, and it was rolled up. And the next morning, they brought this mural, and they unrolled it on the pavement amongst the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And it had some interesting imagery on it. And the idea was is that we would sort of sit around this mural, and as the soldiers would walk by, it was kind of symbolic, they would kind of scratch their heads and ask what it meant. And that would lead to conversations. So I got into some conversations with these young Marines. By this time, I felt, you know, I could talk about this. And, you know, actually, they seemed like pretty good blokes. You know, they when they enlisted, they had no idea they would be ending up in Iraq at all. I mean, they enlisted, I think, because of, you know, the poverty draft and seeing the military as a way to, you know, get to college. And some of them even had some idealism. you know, about liberating the Iraq people, mm-hmm. Which, you know, turned out to be very false, but this was part of their motivation.
Right.
So I did get to talk with some of these guys for a couple of days. And then since then, here in Syracuse, you know, we've had Iraq Veterans Against the War at various events, you know, showing some of their writings and, you know, reading some of their writings and poetry and their art.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we have a wonderful exhibit of art from the Iraq Veterans Against the War at a gallery here called Art Rage.
Oh, I did see that in a local paper that was here. It was the Syracuse Peace newsletter or something.
Right.
That made it out this way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what they have done is they've taken their uniforms and they've cut them up with like scissors and converted them into paper. And using this paper, they've you know drawn in you know images from the Iraq War.
Hmm.
I mean, it's very moving. And then the gallery has had any number of other events connected to it at the gallery, you know, film showings and readings of the veterans' poetry and so forth.
I'm just going to remind the listeners again, we got about 17 minutes until the program ends. If you'd like to reach us, if you have any questions for Ed about what we've been speaking about, the SOA or the Voices in the Wilderness in Iraq, the telephone number here is 315-859-4200. 315-859-4200. And Ed, I just wanted to ask you, are there still people in the Voices from the Wilderness group that are in Iraq now?
Well, the simple answer is not in around Baghdad or Basra or Mosul. We have had some people in the north, more around Sulaymaniyah, but basically the ones that are now active in the Middle East are more in Jordan, working with Iraqi refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And Voices in the Wilderness actually doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the government came down on them for all our civil disobedience and tried to levy a fine on the organization. And the organization is such a grassroots group
mm-hmm.
that there wasn't even a bank account, you know, for or there's no property,
uh-huh.
you know, for the feds to get at.
Yeah.
And so what Voices in the Wilderness did was basically it went out of business, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
But soon thereafter, another group called Voices for Creative Nonviolence emerged in the same neighborhood of Chicago, and it was some of the same people. You know, same mailing list, et cetera. And so that's ongoing now.
Oh, it looks like we've got a call. You want to hold
okay.
that thought, and I'll try to take this call.
Great.
Okay, you are on the air.
Okay, this is, I'm curious if Ed has been back to Iraq since the invasion, and just a general curiosity I have is how I heard the population was about 25 million and there was a pretty big exodus of the Iraqi population after the war, and when I see all the stuff that's going down in Baghdad and so forth, I just wonder how does a civil society operate under the threat of constant violence and so forth, and if he knows anything about like basically if Iraqi was broken, have the pieces begun to been put back together? Will they ever be put back together? Or how is the general civil day-to-day living situation in Baghdad, if he knows any of that?
Okay,
I'll try to take that on. That's a big question. I have not been back since my two...
Oh, Ed, sorry, could you just restart from the beginning? I missed the very beginning of what you were saying.
Okay. I have not been back to Iraq since the two times I was there in 2003. I mean, I would like very much to go back, but the rate of, you know, abductions and kidnappings and killings and so forth is so high bet it would just make a little sense for me to go back. Mm-hmm. So that's too bad, because I'd love to be there. I left part of my heart there. Mm-hmm. Enormous respect for the Iraqi people that I met. As to the other part of the question, things are very bad in Iraq. They're very bad for the invading soldiers, the U.S. soldiers. It's a hellish situation for them, and it's an increasingly hellish situation for the people of Iraq. Your caller mentioned, you know, the several million people that had to flee. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a couple of million of those were able to flee beyond Iraq to neighboring countries. Syria has done an extraordinary job of absorbing, you know, maybe a million Iraqis. I mean, there's no way to really get a close count, but that's the estimate. And, you know, they're living in tough circumstances. They're not living in tents in the desert like some Middle Eastern refugees have. I mean, they're living in little apartments, but those apartments are very expensive, and people's savings are, you know, running out. Mm-hmm. Typically, they're not able to work or get income in the neighboring countries, so it's a race to destitution. Mm-hmm. On their part. But also, within Iraq, there's an enormous amount of displacement. For example, in Baghdad, neighborhoods, which were pretty mixed, Sunni and Shia, now they're kind of getting sorted out, so it's just Sunnis in one neighborhood and Shias in another. And so people have had to move from one neighborhood to somewhere else, and often that entails, you know, losing their home. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it entails moving into the home of someone who has left. So here you may have housing, but it's not your housing, it's someone else's housing. Mm-hmm. And who knows when they'll come back someday when things get sorted out. So it's very much of a struggling situation for people. The condition of women has declined enormously since the invasion. Iraq was a fairly secular country, and women had a relatively high status in Iraq before the invasion. But since the invasion, there's been a rise of fundamentalism, you know, Islamic fundamentalism, which hasn't been good for the status of women. Mm-hmm. And in fact, because there is so much street violence, there's abductions and so forth, my understanding is that women tend to just stay home where it's safer. So that really cramps their style. Whereas before, you know, women were driving on the streets and going to school. And in fact, I spent some time at the university there, and I understood that 70% of the enrollment was women.
Wow.
At the university. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Peter, education, like healthcare in Iraq, was socialized. Mm-hmm. So schooling was free, you know, up through undergraduate years.
Incredible.
Yeah, Iraq was not our stereotypic third world country by any means. It was, in a sense, a first world country, or, you know, on the brink of being a first world country. Mm-hmm. Before it got tangled up with, you know, the U.S. invasions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommended reading for the listeners? Something you've come across that's particularly inspiring or eye-opening?
Well, let's see. I'm moving right now to my bookshelf. Just trying to glance at some of the titles here. I've read quite a number of books on Iraq. Now, one book people might like is Kathy Kelly, who is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She very quickly wrote kind of a memoir that had a lot to do with Iraq. I mean, she won't claim this is great literature herself, because she had to write it under, you know, tough circumstances. But her book is called Other Lands Have Dreams, From Baghdad to Pekin Prison. And Pekin Prison is out in Illinois. It's a federal prison. And she ended up there for, you know, crossing the line at Fort Benning. Mm-hmm. It's published by Counterpunch, paperback. Other Lands Have Dreams. So it's more of a, you know, personalized story.
Mm-hmm.
For analysis, I think you mentioned it earlier, you know, Naomi Klein's book, mm-hmm. on disaster capitalism. I think it's really excellent.
The shock doctrine.
Yeah.
And anything else about, I mean, not to confine you to Iraq or SOA, but other issues or other...
Well, one that's closely connected that I've been involved with is closing Guantanamo.
Hmm.
You know, a number of us were arrested on January 11th. We were in the Supreme Court attempting to do a liturgy in the lobby there when the police kind of rioted. And it led to our being arrested and being detained for about 30 hours. And then we had a trial. We were found guilty, and, you know, I spent a week in the Washington, D.C. Detention Center on the Guantanamo issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very alive. This coming January in Washington, D.C., our group is called Witness Against Torture. We'll be back and kind of establishing a kind of an encampment across from the White House for the first 100 days of the new presidency. Both McCain and Obama have said they would close Guantanamo, but you know how campaign promises are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very important that we keep the pressure on whoever becomes the new president,
right,
regardless of what promises they may have made. So there's a website, it's called witnesstorture.org, which can provide, you know, the background on that if people have some interest in maybe taking part.
Great.
I have another book here that just finished reading a couple of weeks ago, which some of your readers or listeners might be interested in. It's called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. And it's written by Jane Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, who's on the New Yorker magazine staff as an investigative reporter. And I think that's a very rich, though grim, book.
Mm-hmm.
Very well documented and well written. The Dark Side by Jane Mayer.
Thank you. Well, I'll just mention again that you're going to be presenting tomorrow at
yep.
The Other Side.
Yep, 7 p.m.
And we'll be watching a video.
Yeah.
And the title of the video again is?
Guns and Greed.
Guns and Greed, and you'll also be there to speak and take questions.
Yep.
So that's 2011 Genesee Street. It's next to the Cafe Domenico across from the Uptown Theater.
And it's sponsored by the Mohawk Valley Pax Christi and the Mohawk Valley Peace Coalition.
Well, thank you for giving us so much of your time this morning.
Well, Peter, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and very nice to have so much time with you on the line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so often these media things, you don't really get a chance to talk so spaciously,
yeah,
as you allowed me to do this morning. So that feels great.
Great. Well, I really appreciate it. I don't think that things can be explained in a 30-second clip, or even a
right.
Sometimes a 5-minute isn't enough to get it all out. And you find that when you take more time. Some important details that may have been lost to your memory come back to you.
Yeah.
Thanks again. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Sounds good, Pete.
Goodbye.
Bye now.
And that was Ed Kinane that we just heard from. And so I hope that you'll get the opportunity to see him tomorrow at The Other Side. The event is free. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about the program that you just heard, give me a call here at the station. You're listening to WHCL 88.7 FM. I'm broadcasting live from the Bristol Center at Hamilton College. Telephone number here is 315-859-4200. Again, that's 315-859-4200.